Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.
This is Quality of Life, Valley Public Radio's look at the people and the issues affecting the way we live in the San Joaquin Valley. Here is your host, Joe Moore.
Well, good morning. Last week, California's budget battle, stuck for months in a partisan stalemate, turned hot in a rather unusual manner. Thanks to Prop 25, passed by voters in November, lawmakers needed to pass a budget by June 15th in order to avoid forfeiting their pay. On Wednesday, the Democratic-controlled Assembly and Senate sent a budget to Democrat Governor Jerry Brown's desk, who on Thursday stunned many political observers by promptly vetoing the spending plan. Brown said the budget didn't go far enough and relied on the sort of gimmicks and borrowing that have become common in past years in Sacramento. Here's the governor talking about his budget vision back in January of this year.
What I propose will be painful. It's going to take sacrifice from every sector of California. But for 10 years, this state has put together its budget with gimmicks and tricks and unrealistic expectations that have pushed this state deeper and deeper into debt. It's time now to restore California to fiscal solvency and put us on the road to economic recovery and jobs.
On our program today, we'll be talking about the state budget and where we go from here as lawmakers try to find a solution to California's $9.6 billion budget deficit. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can email us at talk@kvpr.org. Later in our program, we'll be joined by Assembly GOP leader Connie Conway of Tulare to get her views on the budget mess, and political science professors Jeff Cummins of Fresno State and Nathan Monroe of UC Merced will join us for analysis of the budget debate. But first, late yesterday afternoon, I had a chance to speak with Democrat Assemblymember Henry T. Perea of Fresno. Mr. Perea, welcome to Quality of Life.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
On Thursday, the governor said the budget continues big deficits for years to come and adds billions of dollars in new debt. It also contains legally questionable maneuvers, costly borrowing, and unrealistic savings. Assemblymember Perea, do you agree with the governor's characterization of the budget? And if you disagree, how so?
Well, first, let me say I was surprised that he did veto the budget only because our leadership had been working with the governor very closely on this budget plan, and as reported in various news accounts, the governor, just days prior to the legislature meeting, had given some indication that this budget proposal would be met with approval in his office. And so that was a little bit of a surprise, but I will say that, you know, the budget we presented to the governor was always Plan B. I mean, Plan A, of course, is the governor's original proposal, which was a mixture of cuts and revenues. But of course, the governor has not had any luck in getting the, you know, four Republican votes, two in each House, in order to make that happen. So, you know, we still prefer option A. We still like to go that road. However, we don't know that we can get there. And quite frankly, I don't know that there are any Republicans out there that are willing to take a chance. I mean, look, the last March, they asked us to make big cuts, and we did. The Democrats voted to cut more than $12 billion from the state budget, real cuts, of which very few Republicans decided to come along with us to do. So even when we gave them the cuts that they were looking for, they still didn't vote for them. So I'm not sure what kind of budget, quite frankly, the Republicans are interested in voting on.
You mentioned this budget that you passed last week as being Plan B. There was another Plan B that the governor outlined back in January, an alternative to his mixture of tax extensions and spending cuts, specifically the so-called worst-case scenario of an all-cuts budget. Is that still on the table, as even as a bargaining chip in some way?
Sure. I think everything is on the table. I mean, look, whenever you're trying to craft a budget, everything has to be on the table. So, you know, I think that, you know, leadership, the governor's office, and the Republicans are hopefully, you know, back at it and looking at other opportunities to craft a budget. But Look, yeah, everything's got to be on the table, and everything will be.
We're talking with Democrat Assemblymember Henry T. Perea of Fresno on Quality of Life today. Some of the critics of the governor's decision to veto the budget said that he wound up weakening his own hand and his own party's hand by vetoing the budget so quickly. If he wanted to do so, he is reducing his negotiating power with Republicans. Do you see that as a concern from your perspective as a member of the Democrat majority?
I do. I mean, I think that the governor, he had 12 days to continue negotiating with Republicans, and could he use this budget as leverage? However, he decided not to. The governor's a smart man. Maybe he's got a different idea, a different plan that a lot of us don't know about. But having said that, I'm just not sure what gets the needed Republican votes that, would get a balanced, bipartisan approach to solving this. I mean, we've been working with Republicans since December on trying to get a compromise plan, and nothing has brought them to the table. So I'm not sure what the governor's next move is. I'm certainly hopeful that he'll be able to find the votes needed in order to pass a bipartisan plan that will get California back on track.
One of the proposals that's been floating around Sacramento for the last month or so that came out of Democratic leadership, it concerns an idea to let local jurisdictions have more say and more authority to levy their own tax and fee increases. And there's been some concern by the business community, Chamber of Commerce groups across the state, that would be a major concern to them, and that they would rather see the tax extensions, the taxes that the Assembly approved back 2 years ago to solve the budget crisis then, see those extended rather than this new idea of allowing local jurisdictions more authority. What's your thoughts on that particular idea that's been floated?
Sure. Well, I would agree with the position of the business community and the chamber, local chambers, that tax extensions is a far much better option than allowing local jurisdictions to have to have the ability to tax anything and everything that they want to. I mean, yeah, I think there's two reasons that I would find it problematic. Number one, you can really create a state of haves and have-nots even more so than we currently have. I mean, wealthier communities won't have a problem, or will have less of a problem in taxing certain items, and poorer communities, for example, in Fresno and the Valley, we don't have the capacity to keep taxing various items, specific items, because we just don't have the money to do that. So, it's problematic from that standpoint, but also just from a business perspective. I mean, it would just be terrible for any business, especially a business that runs a statewide operation, to have to deal with so many different taxing authorities and just taxation models throughout the entire state, that it would make the state very hard to do business in. And so I would tend to agree with the business community that tax extensions is the better way to go in this scenario.
Last week's budget that came through the Assembly is the first in the post-Prop 25 era. This is the proposition last year approved by voters that allowed a simple majority vote to pass the budget, giving Democrats the power to do that in Sacramento. It also includes withholding pay from state legislators for a deadline of June 15th to pass the budget. What are your thoughts, given Controller John Chang's statements about withholding pay from elected officials with this budget that was vetoed by the governor?
Sure. Well, I mean, certainly I believe that we've met our constitutional obligations to deliver a balanced budget. However, whatever the controller decides, I, as well as the rest of the legislature, will comply.
One final thing before we go. Governor Brown has been very adamant on his insistence that the state's redevelopment agencies need to be drastically reformed, and one of the solutions to balancing the budget lies with those redevelopment agency funds. You've been a longtime supporter of redevelopment. What are your thoughts on its course moving forward in this budget battle as we move forward right now?
Well, I still think that there's an opportunity to try to find common ground on the issue of redevelopment. I think that redevelopment agencies are very important. They've done a lot of good work up and down the state in providing affordable housing and removing blight. However, there are many cases that you can point to where redevelopment has been very abusive and has not done what it was intended to do. And so I do think that reform is necessary. I do think that there's an opportunity to try to find the common ground that allows redevelopment to continue, but also to lessen the financial impact that redevelopment has on state government, especially when we're talking about diverting tax increment that would otherwise be going to schools, to cities, and to counties that the state ultimately backfills whenever that money is kept by a local redevelopment agency. And so I see a lot of opportunity. We don't know what the governor's going to do with the redevelopment trailer bill that was a part of the budget. We don't know that he's going to sign it or if he's going to veto it and ask again for complete elimination. From my perspective, I think we should avoid complete elimination and really try to find the compromise that keeps redevelopment working in the right way, but also does it in a way where schools aren't being shortchanged.
Assemblymember Henry T. Perea of Fresno, representing the 31st Assembly District, a Democrat, joining us on our program today. Assemblymember Perea, thank you for joining us.
Hey, you got it. Thanks for having me.
And you're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. We're talking about the state budget today, and we'd like to know what you think. You can email us at talk@kvpr.org. We're joined now on the telephone to get the other side of the political spectrum with Connie Conway, the Assembly GOP leader from Tulare. Connie Conway, welcome to Quality of Life.
Thank you. Good morning.
First of all, your reaction to the governor's veto of the budget passed by the legislature last week. I take it you have a different view of this than Assemblymember Perea.
Oh, I think Assemblymember Perea and I agree on some things, and others we don't. But, in politics, you have to learn that never think that you've got it figured out because there's always something new to come along. And so I also was surprised. I'm not so surprised that the governor might consider vetoing the bill, but the swiftness with which it was done. Yes, I'm going to agree that that was a surprise, I think, to everyone in Sacramento.
Can you characterize for our listeners how the negotiations have gone over the past few months? How involved has the GOP been in working with the Democratic leadership and the governor's office?
Look, we've had somebody at the table from day one, and we even presented our own roadmap that we think is a better way of getting to a budget resolution than some of the other ideas that our friends across the aisle have put forward. But that being said, there has been resistance all along, maybe not so much from the governor, but from those that are really in control of Sacramento, and that would be mostly the labor unions. To reach a compromise to allow some type of budget to move forward. And by that I mean much has been said. The governor made a promise that the governor made, not the rest of us, that there'd be no new taxes without a vote of the people. And in order to do that, he needs Republican votes to put that on the ballot for people to be actually able to vote for taxes. And all Republicans simply ask for were some common sense measures that we think help balance the budget. And by that I mean some pension reform, some regulatory reform, and a spending cap. We think that's a pretty simple ask. In fact, the polling will tell you that the voters want to vote on those three things, and they don't have any hesitation in saying that, yes, we need to reform the pension system. California definitely needs a spending cap. And regulatory reform would go a long way into making the ability of businesses to continue to function. Because, look, our position all along is you can't tax your way out of a situation, but you can grow yourself out of this situation. And by that, we mean allowing people to have a job. That's what people want. People want to go to work. They want to support their family. They want to take care of themselves. And we believe that the anti-business climate in California has gone a long way in keeping business from allowing itself to grow and allow people to have a job.
We're talking with Assembly Republican Leader Connie Conway of Tulare on Quality of Life today. earlier in the late winter and early spring, Republicans took some criticism from political observers for not offering their own plan. However, after the governor's May revise came out and additional good news came in the form of additional revenues coming into Sacramento, Republicans did announce a plan, and one that, according to GOP leadership, helped to protect education and public safety. Where does that plan differ, in your view, from what the governor and Democratic leaders have proposed?
Well, and first, I would just like to say, for the record, we actually put our plan out before the governor's May revise, and we think that it might have changed his look on his May revise because we did protect education and public safety, and there had to be some scrambling there because if Republicans could do it, why couldn't Democrats do it too? But that being said, you know, what I learned as a member of the Board of Supervisors and what I hear from taxpayers every day, taxpayers understand taxes. They do get that. They understand that they have to contribute and that that there's worthwhile things worth paying taxes for. And their priorities, when you ask them, are a safe community. It's very important to the general public. A good school for their children. In fact, sometimes people move within communities. They want to know, where are the good schools? That's where I want my kids. And some type of infrastructure, whether that's a road or a phone line or electricity service or a technological infrastructure, which these days, of course, is important to everyone in California. So our roadmap simply says honor those things first and make sure those things are secure in your budget proposal, and then we'll get to the other periphery ideas, which sometimes take precedence over what the taxpayers believe they're paying taxes for. And our roadmap simply, it did use the new revenue that was available, which is a good thing, and we used ideas that have been out there by others. The Little Hoover Commission had made several, had several ideas that we based our roadmap on. The Legislative Analyst Office, the nonpartisan legislative office that frequently weighs in on issues in Sacramento, and even the UC systems themselves, they had put a proposal out a couple of years ago that they would like to take over and reduce the cost of health care for prison systems. And they had, we thought, a unique proposal. We thought one that would benefit the UC systems and take care of some of the health care issues that we're under federal fire for with the prison systems and save money for hardworking taxpaying Californians. So our roadmap simply says honor the priorities of the taxpayers, with acknowledging that there are other items that Californians wish to fund with those tax dollars, and we get that. We think there's that our plan is a better way to getting there.
A number of things come up in the give and take of budget negotiations in Sacramento, and about a month ago, one thing that was floated out there by Democrat leaders was a plan to allow local jurisdictions more authority to levy their own taxes and fee increases. Where does that stand with the Republican minority and your views on that proposal? Do you think that is something that the Democrats are actually planning to advance, or is that more of a bargaining chip that is designed to get business and some other groups that would be impacted by that on board to support the governor's proposal of the sales tax extensions?
I'm not sure whose brilliant idea that was, but you know, local communities already have that the opportunity to do that. For example, where I live in the city of Tulare, went out and asked for an extra 1 cent sales tax to support local law enforcement. Countywide, we went out and passed a road tax, Measure R, it was called at the time, for roads to increase the ability to fix and start new projects and to draw down federal dollars. So personally, I think communities already have some of those opportunities already. But really, that's just passing the buck. You know, we were sent to Sacramento to be responsible to the taxpayers, and that's what we need to be doing. That's what we need to focus on. And so even for the governor's desire, you know, 5 years to extend taxes, and let's not forget when these taxes were sold, if you will, if that's the right word, to people a few years back, they were temporary. They were to fix a temporary problem. Adding 5 years of temporary taxes doesn't pass the smell test in my mind. And I think that the taxpayers, if given the chance to vote on that, will probably agree. One of the things that's happened with this agreement on whether we should put something on the ballot or not, we are simply asking for those simple measures that I mentioned before. But I will tell you, in my roadmap, in my mind, it's like, why do we have to bargain with people on issues that would seem to make common sense? Why can't we have pension reform? Why aren't our friends across the aisle, the Democrats, who actually have the ability to pass a budget without us? They need us to raise taxes, but the law gives them this opportunity. And for the 2 years that I've been in Sacramento, that's all I heard was just give us that power. Give us the ability to pass a budget, and we will do it on time, and we can get this done, and that's going to solve all the problems. Well, that didn't happen, even though they have the ability to do that. We're still there, willing to work. We've been at the table every day. We offer our ideas. We think they're pretty common sense. The idea that they would threaten businesses and threaten other industries and even threaten the taxpayers with closing school for 2 months and all of the other ideas that they've come up with threaten people into thinking that they need to pay more taxes is inherently wrong, in my opinion. Tell the taxpayers the truth. I do never underestimate the taxpayers' ability to figure this out. Every small business, every household has to live within its own budget, and they've learned how to do that. And I think Californians are ready for Sacramento to do the same thing. Take what we have, use it in the best and highest way, balance a budget, and then move on. In fact, I suggested to the governor, why can't we live within our means just this once for the first time, have a balanced budget for the first time in how many, at least 20 years that I can remember. And then, if you still believe you need more help from the taxpayers, I think you have a better argument to go back to them and say, okay, we lived within our means, and this is what it looks like. Now we're asking you to help us some more. I think that's an entirely different conversation that that all of California needs to have together to right the state. Where I live in the Central Valley, people are having a terrible time. So when we ask people for more taxes, you're asking to tax people who don't have the ability to do that. Unemployment is high. We are very much ag-based, and when ag is your only employment opportunity and ag isn't faring well, there are fewer opportunities. I think we all remember last year when there was no water and there was no jobs. We've got to stop that cycle. We've got to live within our means and try to grow jobs and the economy in the state of California and bring it back to its golden self once again.
Before we go, one final question. There's been a lot of discussion in the days since Thursday with Governor Brown's veto of the budget in regards to what this means with the new mandate in Prop 25 that legislators forfeit their pay if a budget is not passed. Where do you stand on that issue with the state controller and the remarks he's made thus far on enforcing that provision?
Look, you know, I'm not a lawyer, and I haven't, don't know that I'm the right one to opine on the statute of Prop 25, but the people passed 25, and it is in statute, and they expect to have a budget delivered on time. And to their satisfaction. And I believe that the Democrats who are in charge of that believe that they did that. They believe they met the letter of the law. Mr. Pereira was right when he said that we didn't necessarily support their plan. We supported parts of it, and those votes were taken. And so I think the Democrats believe they met the letter of the law and provided the budget on time. I'm not sure where it says in Prop 25 that Mr. Chang becomes the person who makes that decision. I'm not sure, but I believe that it is the law and we should meet the law. The argument is now between the Democrats themselves on whether they met the letter of the law in order for that to happen, and I expect that discussion to continue. As for my part, as I say, I'm not the legal authority that makes those decisions. But I like the people, believe that when a law is passed, we should meet the law. And I guess the discussion now depends on the powers that be, whether they decide the letter of the law was met or not.
Well, Assembly GOP leader Connie Conway, we thank you for joining us today on our program. Certainly uncharted territory in a number of respects in Sacramento. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm happy to do so. Thank you.
All right. You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. We'll be back in just a moment with a little analysis of the state budget mess with Jeff Cummins and Nathan Monroe, political science professors from Fresno State and UC Merced, respectively. And we'll take your calls at 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. That's coming up in just a moment on Quality of Life here on Valley Public Radio. You're listening to a rebroadcast of today's edition of Quality of Life. When you hear the phone numbers, please don't call. This is Quality of Life on FM 89. My name is Joe Moore, and we're talking about the state budget on our program today, and we'd like to know what you think. Call us at 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. And stay tuned in a little bit. In our final segment today, we'll be talking about the effort to ban chocolate milk from school lunch menus throughout the Golden State. It's happened in Los Angeles Unified and other parts of California. We'll talk about that and get your thoughts. But right now, turning back to the state budget, we're joined in our studio by two guests, actually one in studio, one on the telephone. In studio, we have Jeff Cummins, political science professor from Fresno State. Jeff, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And on the phone, we're joined by Nathan W. Monroe, a political science professor from the University of California, Merced. Nathan, welcome to our program as well.
Thank you.
First of all, gentlemen, let's start in talking about this issue that has just arisen in the last couple of days with the governor's veto of the budget, a Democrat governor vetoing a budget presented by a Democratic-controlled Senate and Assembly. This is uncharted territory. Jeff, I'll give you first crack at this one.
Yeah, it's hard to know what to make of it. And I've heard how the record keepers have gone back and checked the state records and haven't found anything like this in the last 100 years, going back to when we didn't have records of our state budget. I guess the somewhat surprising thing is that normally you have an executive and the legislators from the same party who are in discussions on budget as well as any other legislation. They typically try and provide a united front on these major issues like the budget. So you would assume that Governor Brown and the Democratic leaders in the legislature had been talking about, you know, what would happen if the legislature did pass this budget with just a majority vote. They would have had some idea of what Governor Brown was going to do about it. It seems by the reaction from Senate Majority Leader Daryl Steinberg and John Perez that they were caught off guard by this. They expected him to veto it. But the message that I think the governor is sending is that he appears to be serious about this commitment to not pass a gimmick-plagued budget. He could have waited around for another week or so and used it as leverage with the Republicans, but it seems like he wanted to send the message that he's serious, that he wants to close the gap between expenditures and revenues.
Turning to Professor Monroe joining us on the telephone from Merced today, we knew Governor Jerry Brown going into office was hard to predict and a rather unusual politician. Is this just Governor Brown proving the rule that we saw in his first round as governor, that he is often one to buck his own party and go his own route, or is this part of a larger plan that that maybe we don't know the entire story on just yet?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm inclined. I mean, it's probably a little of both, but I'm inclined to sort of lean toward the latter. You know, it's in a circumstance like this, one in which we really haven't seen the sort of set of conditions line up the way that they have in a very long time, if and certainly never in California. I think it's entirely possible that many governors, not just Jerry Brown would have acted very similarly, and the situation might have played out similarly. Because, you know, you have the situation where in the past you've had, you know, required two-thirds majorities in both chambers to pass a budget. And so, you know, the idea that a governor is then going to veto a budget when the legislature can, by the same vote margin, override that veto and pass the budget without essentially the consultation of the governor, is, you know, made it sort of implausible that a governor would veto a budget for a variety of reasons. So you now have this very first instance where the legislature has the ability to pass a majority budget. On top of that, right, they have a deadline to pass a budget of some sort, and there's a sort of debate about whether it's passage or enactment, in order to continue to be paid. And so, you know, I think that there's a lot of moving parts here that affect both, you know, the nature of the budget and the intention of the budget that was put together and sent to the governor, as well as the sort of bargaining environment that exists, right? I mean, you know, we talk a lot about bargaining over the budget at the federal level, where, of course, it's a majority to pass in both chambers the budget in Congress, but two-thirds to override. And so the governor, or, I mean, the president in that case, does have some veto leverage for bargaining, and we see the first instance of that here in California. And so I think it's a little bit, you know, it's not as surprising, I think, as some would have you believe that we had a veto in this first instance.
The governor has been very insistent on getting some level of Republican support for his plan, much to the concern of Democrats who say it's just not there. Is this some effort to try to politically triangulate in some way and gain Republican support that might be there at some point and spread the potential political pain of the consequences across the parties? What are your views, Professor Monroe?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's probably a little bit of that, but I mean, now in, you know, in this case, I guess I think we do get more, you know, a little closer to the sort of Brown specific, which is, I think it maybe is less posturing and sort of political navigation and more about, you know, what he believes to be the sort of right kind of budget, right? So, you know, a sort of a more moderate budget that sort of has a mix of spending cuts and you know, revenue increases, and so I think that you know is much more likely to be sort of a factor in his consideration here than it is trying to plan for some sort of, you know, electoral consideration in the next round.
Turning back to Professor Cummins from Fresno State, who joins us in our studio today, you heard Connie Conway on our program just a few moments ago talk about her involvement and Republicans' involvement with the governor and the Democratic leadership over the past few months and their goals of seeing some changes in pension reform and environmental regulations, other regulatory reform. Do you see Republicans winning any concessions there and perhaps some Republicans going over to support a budget that might win the support of Governor Brown?
I think it's a definite possibility. I mean, Governor Brown has come out and said that he does support a spending cap, which is one of the reforms that the Republicans are seeking. He does support business regulations, revamping business regulations to make California more business friendly. So he has committed to these Republican reforms. I think the sticking point is more the severity of what the Republicans want. We have some reports coming out, and this isn't that surprising, that whenever the Republicans come out with their conditions for passing the task extensions onto the voters, that the labor representatives are not happy with what the Republicans want, and that's essentially keeping Governor Brown from agreeing to what the Republicans want. So it's a matter of, and we've actually heard on the spending cap, there seems to be quite a bit of agreement. The one thing I would point out about what the Republicans are seeking is that, in terms of the short-term budget problem that we have, which is the essence of the problem is that ongoing expenditures exceed ongoing revenues into the foreseeable future, that these reforms are not going to fix that structural deficit that we have. They certainly address some serious problems that the state is facing out into the future. But for example, the pension reforms that they are seeking, right now the state contributes about $3 billion to our state pension programs. And so these reforms that they're seeking are not going to substantially close the much larger gap that the governor is trying to fill with the tax extensions of $10 billion. So I think that's important to point out.
Isn't that Republicans trying to extract some political concessions now that their power has been reduced by Prop 25 and their last major bargaining chip is their ability to they have the, still with the two-thirds requirement for passing tax extensions. That's their bargaining joy.
Sure, certainly.
Do you see enough Republicans defecting from the party line to do that? We've seen it in the past. We saw it 2 years ago when these taxes, these temporary tax extensions, which are due to expire July 1st, first came into office. The Republicans seem to be more unified this year, do they not?
Well, that's an interesting question. And we've seen from the very start of it, since the governor has been negotiating with four GOP senators mainly, we haven't heard as much about the negotiations that he's having with assembly members. But it seems that there certainly are some Republicans that are willing to go along with just putting the taxes on the ballot, right? So I think one of the problems that you have is that even if we put these taxes on the ballot, there's certainly no guarantee that voters are going to support them. And so I think it's a bigger risk than if the governor was negotiating for the GOP to support raise or extending the taxes directly versus putting it on the ballot. So it's somewhat of a bigger risk than what they've been looking at in the past. But I think one of the interesting aspects of how these negotiations have unfolded, and I think this is a reflection of term limits, is that the governor's not negotiating with the party leaders for the Republicans. He's not negotiating with the Senate Majority Leader. He's not negotiating with the Assembly Republican Leader. He's negotiating with some of the rank and file who have come out early and said that they would be willing to support putting taxes on the ballot in exchange for these pension reforms. And if we contrast that with what took place in 2009 was the year in which we originally got these taxes with the support of GOP leaders Mike Valliens and Dave Cogdill. They were the leaders of their party. So we kind of see how the leadership for the minority party is not playing the role that it has in the past.
Turning back to Professor Monroe from UC Merced, these taxes, the ones that Governor Brown has been so adamant should be extended, are due to expire July 1st. Does that make it that much harder to get these that sort of revenue coming in the future? Because in that case, it wouldn't be a tax extension. It would be a new tax increase. Voters are already leery of these sorts of things. How do you see that playing politically with California voters?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how, you know, whether a tax increase is meaningfully different from a sort of tax extension in the minds of many voters. I'm sure that it makes some difference. But the bottom line is, I think many voters feel sort of very, you know, overburdened by many, you know, financially by many, you know, things, you know, some of them personal, some of them that, you know, tie into the world and national economy, and some of them that tie directly into the state, you know, fiscal situation. And so I think whether it's a tax extension or what we would call a new tax increase, you know, given the expiration date of July 1, I think either way there's a bit of an uphill battle to get voters to approve, you know, these new taxes, you know, new taxes or tax extensions. I think it's by no means a guarantee that even if they, you know, end up on the ballot that we're going to see those things pass.
In the few minutes we have remaining here, I want to turn to Prop 25 and get your opinions on the status of this, again, uncharted territory that we find ourselves in Sacramento with this new law passed by voters back in November that not only institutes the majority budget, which we saw in action last week, but also mandating that legislators forfeit their pay if that budget is not, well, is it passed or is it approved? And the state controller has been very, shall we say, vocal in demonstrating his particular view on this. How do you see this playing out? Start with you, Professor Monroe.
You're asking specifically about the paychecks portion?
Yes, exactly. The paychecks portion.
I think it's not entirely clear, but my guess is that no matter how the sort of decision, you know, how it's decided as to whether or not the budget is, you know, the budget the previously passed budget is counted as satisfying the requirement, that's probably, you know, that's going to go to court, and so, you know, on either, you know, no matter how it's decided, and so I think that we have a bit of a, you know, sort of a, it'll probably be a bit of a drawn out process before we know the answer to that for sure. But you know, my hunch is though that a budget deal is going to get done, you know, sooner rather than later. But sooner may not be, you know, sooner is probably not going to be soon enough, so that some legislators would actually, you know, feel the effect of not getting a paycheck, if in fact that's the way that goes.
Professor Cummins, before we go, your thoughts on where we're headed with the state budget as we move forward? Is it going to be sooner, or is it going to be later, or much later?
I think it's really hard to say given all the variables. We have the redistricting maps coming out as well, so a lot of legislators aren't sure what their districts are going to look like. But in terms of the Prop 25, it symbolizes or represents one of the downsides to ballot initiatives, in that what wasn't in the ballot initiative was who would decide whether that budget was a balanced budget, essentially. Who would decide whether or not legislators got their pay. Now, the controller, John Chung, has asserted himself into this argument. He can make the decision. More than likely, we'll see some sort of a lawsuit on that decision.
And on that note, we'll have to leave it right there. We have more to talk about on our program today, but we'd like to thank our guests in this segment. Joining us in studio, Jeff Cummins, political science professor at Fresno State, and on the telephone, Nathan W. Monroe, political science professor at UC Merced. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us. We'll be right back in just a moment and talk about the effort to remove chocolate milk from school lunch menus. It's an effort to fight obesity and diabetes and other conditions in school children. We'll get the different sides of the story in just a minute on Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Quality of Life comes from Chevron and Abyssinia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of today's edition of Quality of Life. When you hear the phone numbers, please don't call. You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Across the state and nation, the struggle to fight childhood obesity is being waged on a variety of fronts. From YouTube PSAs by First Lady Michelle Obama encouraging kids to exercise, to grassroots campaigns aimed at developing healthy eating habits, it's an issue of concern to many parents and educators. Last week, the Los Angeles Unified School District Board took on a longtime staple of the school lunch menu, voting 5-2 to remove chocolate and other flavored milk products from its school lunch menus. The move was hailed by food activists, who note that a cup of chocolate milk contains 20 grams of sugar versus just 12 grams for regular non-fat milk. On the other side, critics, including the dairy industry and the Heart Association, argue that the move may wind up hurting kids who otherwise might not enjoy the nutritional benefits of milk. As always, we'd like to know what you think. Should chocolate milk be banned at Valley schools, or is this a case of good intentions going too far? Call us with your thoughts, 559-275-8989, or toll free, 800-224-8989. Joining us now on the phone, or actually joining us now in studio, we have a guest, Shelley Mattson, registered dietitian at Madera Community Hospital in Madera. Shelley, welcome to our program.
Yes, good morning. Thank you.
And we also have a guest joining us on the telephone here in just a second. Before we do that, I want to play a clip from a television program that helped initiate a lot of this discussion. British TV celebrity chef Jamie Oliver's ABC television program Food Revolution has taken on the issue of the nation's school lunch menus, and here's a stunt that Mr. Oliver aired on his program recently.
What goes on pretty much across the whole of the United States and in LA here is every child has to have a milk every day. Most kids are getting flavored milk. 75 to 85% of all milk is flavored milk. 1 8-ounce little tub of flavored milk has 28 grams of sugar. Okay? What I'm gonna do right now is I'm gonna pump this bus, this icon of trust, full of 1 week's worth of added sugar just for flavored milk in the LAUSD. Okay, guys, take it away. Let's pump it. A truck and a week's worth of added sugar. And if that doesn't upset people, then I don't know what will.
Cue the dramatic music here. That was Jamie Oliver from his TV program Food Revolution, and that's an ABC television series that helped generate a lot of discussion on this particular issue. Turning to our guest in studio, Shelley Mattson, what are your thoughts on this issue of nutrition and milk? This has been a longtime staple of the school lunch menu, but obesity and the complications that it can bring about, including diabetes, is a huge and growing concern. Do you see this as a good move for kids or one that might have unintended consequences?
Yes, again, thank you for having me. I am a registered dietitian, and, you know, there are benefits of low-fat and non-fat milk. There's 9 essential nutrients in them that growing kids and adolescents need. The calcium is bone-strengthening. There's potassium, phosphorus. The protein content is adequate to help kids with growing. The dietary guidelines do recommend that growing children, about 9 to 18, get 3 servings, which would be about 1 cup per serving, 3 servings a day of low-fat dairy milk, low-fat yogurt, cheese, low-fat cheese, or fortified soy milk to get these nutrients. And then there's the new launch of the My Plate from the United States Department of Agriculture, which has an image next to the plate representing the importance of receiving these nutrients. The flavored milk has these same essential nutrients, however, with the addition of sugar. And there is, unfortunately, more sugar than the plain milk, and it's in the form of high fructose corn syrup. This is not an essential nutrient for our kids to be having. So as a dietitian, I am concerned about our children's health and nutrition, especially during a time where the number of children who are overweight has doubled among 2 to 5-year-olds and has more than tripled among 6 to 11-year-olds. So cutting out the sugar is a good choice for the schools.
Let's go to the phones now and talk to a guest joining us from Southern California, Jenny Cook from the group Food for Lunch. It's a parents organization that helped bring about this change in LA Unified. Jenny, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tell us about your views on this issue. We played a clip from the Jamie Oliver program just a little while ago on our air today, and it certainly was presented in quite a dramatic fashion. You feel that this is a big victory for kids and for parents. What does this mean for our schools?
Well, it means that our food service directors have an awareness of what our kids need to stay healthy, and it means that the paradigm may be shifting. LAUSD serves an amazing amount of meals a day, 688,000 per day, so millions per week. They're doing an outstanding job, but what they're doing is serving a lot of processed and denatured food, and when you do that, you're creating taste buds that prefer sweet things and processed things. And I really think that we need to start, especially in the younger years, and start helping our kids acquire a taste towards whole foods that are good for them as opposed to sugar and processed foods.
There have been critics that say this is a step too far, that this is certainly an issue that needs to be addressed, and there's a number of things that can be done, and that many efforts have already been successful or showing promise in getting soft drinks and other types of sugary beverages out of the schools. But that this ban on chocolate and other flavored milk products is potentially detrimental because maybe kids won't consume the non-flavored milk and they wouldn't receive the benefits. Is that a valid concern in your opinion, or is that misplaced?
Well, if it's a concern, then it's valid. You know, I can't tell people what to be concerned about. I can tell people that that our kids are getting fat and unhealthy, and that we have to start somewhere, and that I agree, you know, there is that nanny state idea of, you know, once you start monitoring my beverages, you know, everything's going to just fall apart and you're going to be all up in my face. But the soda ban was in 2004, so that was quite some time ago. And to get current with what's happening in food science, we need to take into account that sugar is the main thing that's ruining our health these days, sugar and processed foods. So if we continue to create the paradigm where kids get, and the diet where kids get sugar and processed food from the time that they're in kindergarten, we're creating more disease. So unless we get our kids healthier food, unless we all realize and come together as a community and realize what healthy foods are and how that looks like, and it doesn't look like that if you're watching TV or if you're in a supermarket, we really have to really take a hard look at what we're feeding ourselves and where we're getting our food from.
We're talking about the effort to remove chocolate milk and other flavored milk products from the menus of California's school district lunch menus, and Jenny Cook from the group Food for Lunch joins us on the telephone. We're also joined now by Dino Giacomazzi, the owner of the Giacomazzi Dairy in Hanford. Dino, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This has been a move that has been criticized on a number of fronts. Not only the dairy industry, but also groups like the American Heart Association have issued their concerns about this move. What do you think about the idea that chocolate milk should be removed from the school lunch menus?
Well, I think in a way, the decision to remove chocolate milk from the school is kind of, in a way, throwing the baby out with the bathwater. When you look at the many benefits of milk, including chocolate and strawberry and other flavored milks, the research and the statistics show that the benefits of the nutrients, the protein, the calcium, and the other benefits of milk far outweigh the concern of the sugar. And if you look at the makeup of milk, you know, there is natural...
Where's that report?
There's natural sugar in the milk, lactose, and the added sugar in chocolate milk only is about 2 to 3% additional sugar. And I don't have the report right here in front of me, but there are many studies that indicate that milk in the diet actually helps reduce the risk of heart attack and stroke. If you look at some of the benefits that chocolate milk has been providing to athletes, for example, Fresno State is one of the leading universities in the country that have replaced sports drinks with chocolate milk as a recovery beverage because of the benefits that milk provides.
So
the idea would be to get kids in the habit of choosing milk, whether it be flavored or otherwise, instead of sodas, and get them in the habit of doing it. So when they're away from school, they may make the decision to choose that over soda, which is more than 50% of teenager sugar intake in a day.
We're talking about the decision to remove chocolate milk from school lunch menus on our program today. Let's go to the phones and talk to a caller, Susan, on line 3 from Bakersfield. Susan, you're on Quality of Life.
Hi.
Yes, tell us your thoughts.
I just have an interesting anecdote, and that is, you know, I'm in favor of healthy food choices, too. My son took his bag lunch to school 7 or 8 years ago, and bought a milk. And the cafeteria lady decided that only children who bought the school lunch could have the chocolate milk, and the brown bag children had to buy the plain milk. And my son would not buy milk anymore. And so I went to school and I tasted the difference between the plain milk and the chocolate milk. And the plain milk was horrendous. It tasted like the carton, and it didn't taste anything like the milk in our house. And so when I brought that to the attention of the cafeteria director, all she did was back off and let everybody buy chocolate milk again. She didn't investigate why the white milk tasted so bad. And so I'm wondering if children know something that adults don't know, that's all. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, that's very interesting, Susan. We thank you for that call. That's certainly illustrates some of the interesting paradoxes that we often find in the schools. Turning to Jenny, have you seen anything like that? Schools with rules such as that, the students have to buy chocolate milk or have to buy plain milk, things like that.
Well, the rule is that's wild. I can't even believe that you talked about a nanny state. That's just crazy talk. I can't even believe that was happening. But they do have to offer two kinds of milk. They have to offer. They can offer 1% and 2%. But what they usually offer is a 2% and a flavored like a strawberry or a chocolate. I can tell you, and I'd love to hear the dairy man's comment on this. I do know that it is industry practices to use older milk for chocolate milk sometimes when it's past the due date because the cocoa and the sugar cover the flavor of the sour milk. Now, I love sour cream and buttermilk, so I know it's not going to hurt me, but at the same time, it certainly is something that would affect a child's taste bud or, say, a lactose intolerant child's stomach. You know, so there is a question about that. And I don't think that if you're trying to promote people drinking milk, you should not compare it to soda. I think that water is a good recovery drink. I think that water is a good thing for elementary school and preschool kids to drink with their breakfast and their lunch. I think we're really tipping the scales here and trying to entertain ourselves on taste buds at every given point. And the bottom line is food is to feed us and nourish us. It is not to entertain us, you know, seven times a day. That's a bonus. It doesn't have to happen all the time, you know?
Yeah. I'd like to pass on some comments we just received on our Twitter feed. This is from Luke in Fresno. He said, I get bans on soda in school, but not chocolate milk. We need to teach kids to make good decisions, not just ban things. And this comes from Bradley in Fresno. He said, we are slowly robbing the joys of childhood in the name of health. Before we go, we just have a few seconds left on our program. One concern, and I'll turn back to our guest, our registered dietitian, Shelley Mattson, in our studio today. One concern that's been brought up in terms of sugar content, many of the fruit drinks and fruit beverages, fruit juices that children are consuming in schools have a lot of sugar in them as well. In some cases, as much, if not more, than or in a cup of flavored milk. Shelley, what do you see on that? Is it more beneficial for that student to consume the milk that has that added sugar or juices as important for other reasons?
The juices are 100% fruit juice, and some of them do contain a small amount more sugar than the flavored milks. I do think water is, of course, the best drink for children, then the low-fat, non-fat milks to provide extra nutrients, and then 100% fruit juice, then flavored milk, and then soda, of course, is not healthy for our children. So in that order, I think there's scientific evidence to back that up. So.
Well, we thank you very much for joining us today. That just about does it for our program. I'd like to thank our guests, Jenny Cook from the LA-based group Food for Lunch, joining us on the telephone. Also, Hanford-based dairy owner Dino Giacomazzi, joining us on the telephone from Hanford. And again, Shelley Mattson, a registered dietitian at Madera Community Hospital. Shelley, thank you for coming into our studio today for our program. That's all for Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. I'm Joe Moore for Marv Allen, our audio engineer, producer and operations manager Don Weaver, and our producer Tracy Sharman. This is Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Thank you.
Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.